get hurt at the cannery, she said. You're going to be all right.
Then, in English, she added,
sweet dreams.
In the morning, he woke with a start, a dream ending with a flash of pain. The sheet smelled of cigarettes and sweat, and he knew that she'd slept next to him. Beside the pallet was a jar filled with urine that looked tinctured with iodine. At least it was clear. He reached to touch the jar. It was cold. When he managed to sit up, there was no sign of her. The light was amplified by the sea, filling the room. He pulled off his sheet. Bright bruising fanned his chest, and there were pressure cuts on the ribs. His stitches were crusty, and after smelling them, he knew they'd have to be expressed. The loudspeaker greeted him.
Citizens, today it is announced that a delegation is to visit America to confront some of the problems facing our two fearsome nations.
Then the broadcast went on in the usual formula, evidence of the worldwide admiration for North Korea, an example of Kim Jong-il's divine wisdom, a new method to help citizens avoid starvation, and finally, warnings to civilians from various ministries. A draft through the window set the dried fish swaying on their lines, the cartilage of their fins the color of lantern paper. From the roof came a series of yips and howls, and the constant clicking of nails on cement. For the first time in days, he felt a pang of hunger. Then the door opened, and breathing hard, the second mate's wife came in. She was carrying a suitcase and 2 5-liter jugs of water. She was sweating, but there was a weird smile on her face.
What do you think of my new suitcase? She asked. I had to barter for it.
What did you barter?
Don't be an ass, she said. Can you believe I didn't own a suitcase?
I guess you never went anywhere.
I guess I never went anywhere,
she said to herself. She ladled some rice water into a plastic cup for him. He took a drink and asked her, Are there dogs on the roof?
That's life on the top floor, she said. Broken elevator, leaky roof, toilet vents. I don't even notice the dogs anymore. The housing council's breeding them. You should hear them on Sundays.
What are they breeding them for? Wait, what happens on Sundays?
The guys at the karaoke bar say that dogs are illegal in Pyongyang.
That's what they say.
Civilization, she said.
Aren't they going to start missing you at the cannery? She didn't answer. Instead, she knelt down and began rifling the pockets of the suitcase, looking for any evidence of its previous owner. Jeon-do said, They're going to give you a criticism session.
I'm not going back to the cannery, she said.
Not ever?
No, she said. I'm going to Pyongyang.
You're going to Pyongyang.
That's right, she said.
In a fold of the suitcase's lining, she found some expired travel passes, stamped by every checkpoint between Kaesong and Chongjin.
Typically, it takes a couple weeks, but I don't know. I got a feeling it could happen any day.
What could happen?
Them finding my replacement husband.
And you think he's in Pyongyang?
I'm a hero's wife, she said.
A hero's widow, you mean?
Don't say that word, she said. I hate the sound of it.
Jeon-do finished his rice water and slowly, slowly lay back down.
Look, she said. It's horrible what happened to my husband. I can't even think about it. Seriously, when my mind goes there, something inside me just turns away. But we were only married a few months, and he was on a boat with you almost the whole time.
It had taken a lot out of him to sit up, and when his head touched the pallet, the comfort of yielding to exhaustion overtook the discomfort of recovery. Almost everything on him hurt, yet a feeling of well-being came over his body, as if he'd been working hard all day with his mates. He closed his eyes and felt the hum of it. When he opened them again, it was afternoon. Jeon-do had a feeling that what had awakened him was the sound of her closing the door as she left. He rolled some so he could see the corner of the room. There was the pan that she used to wash herself. He wished he could reach it to check if the water was still warm. Come twilight, the captain stopped by. He lit a couple of candles and sat in a chair. Looking up at him, Jundo could see he'd brought a bag.
"Look here, son,"
the captain said, and from the bag produced a slab of tuna and two Ruksong beers.
"It's time to get your health back."
The captain opened the bottles and sectioned the tuna raw with his bosun's knife.
"Two heroes,"
the captain said, and half-heartedly they both drank. The tuna, though, was exactly what Jundo needed. The fat of the sea, he savored it against the roof of his mouth.
"The catch was good?"
Jundo asked.
"The waters were lively," the captain said. "It wasn't the same without you or the second mate, of course. We got a couple hands to help out from the Quan Li. You heard their captain ended up losing his arm, right?"
Jundo nodded. The captain shook his head.
"You know, I'm real sorry about how they worked you over. I wanted to warn you, but it wouldn't have made much difference."
"Well, it's over," Jundo said.
"The hard part's over, and you took it well. No one else could have done what you did. Now comes the reward part," the captain said. "They're going to give you some time to heal up, figure out exactly how things will work, and then they're going to want to show you off. A hero who risked his life at gunpoint to save another hero who'd been fed to the sharks by Americans? Come on, you're going to be a big story. They're going to get some use out of you. After that thing with the canning master, and then the captain of the Quan Li, they need some good news. Anything you want, you'll be able to name it."
"I've already been to language school," Jundo said, then added, "You think it's possible, I mean with the currents and all, that he could make it back?"
"We all love that boy," the captain said. "And mistakes were made, but he can't come back. He's not part of the story anymore. That's not how the story goes now. You've got to get your head straight about that. The girl, she's doing okay with this, right?"
But before Jundo could answer, the captain noticed the chart on the wall. The room was dim, and he stood with his candle.
"What the hell?"
he said. He started tearing out pins and dropping them to the floor.
"A week he's been gone, and still that kid is tormenting me."
He pulled the chart free.
"Look,"
the captain said,
"there's something you should know. Before, when we thought the second mate hadn't taken anything with him, we really hadn't looked close enough. We didn't think to check down in the hold, where your equipment was."
"What are you saying?"
"One of your radios is gone. He took a radio with him."
"Was it the black one?" Jundo asked. "Or the one with the silver handles?"
"The one with the green dials,"
the captain said.
"Is that going to be a problem? Is this going to hurt us?"
Jundo could see it so clearly now. The second mate out on the raft in the dark, with nothing but a battery, the green glow of a radio, and cigarettes without matches. "That radio's pretty basic," Jundo said. "We can scrounge another one."
"That's the spirit,"
the captain said. He put on a smile.
"Here, here. I'm being an idiot. Have some more tuna. And the girl, what do you think of her? I talked to her, you know. She has quite a high impression of you. What can I get you? Is there anything you need?"
The beer was running right through Jundo. "That jar over there," he said. "Can you hand it to me?"
"Sure, sure,"
the captain said. But when he picked it up, he eyed it with great suspicion. He looked like he was going to smell it, but then he just passed it along. Jundo rolled to his side and brought the jar under the sheet with him. Then the only sound in the room was the sound of urine filling the jar in fits and spurts. The captain talked over the sound.
"Well, you're going to have to do some thinking. You're a hero now, and they're going to ask you what you want. How about it? Is there anything you'd pick?
When he was done, Jun Do opened his eyes. Then he carefully handed the jar to the captain.
The only thing I'd like, Jun Do said, is to stay on the Jun Ma. I feel comfortable there. Of course you do, the captain said. Your equipment's there.
And there's power at night.
And there's power at night, the captain said. Consider it done. You now live on the Jun Ma. It's the least I can do. But what is it you really want? Something only the officials can give you.
Jun Do hesitated. He took a pull of beer and tried to think of one thing that North Korea could give him that would make his life better. The captain sensed his hesitation and started describing others who'd done great deeds and the prizes they'd asked for.
Like the guys in Yongbyon, who put out the fire at the power plant. One of them got a car. It was in the paper. Another guy wanted his own telephone. Done. No questions. They ran a wire to his apartment. When you're a hero, that's how it works.
I'd have to think about it, Jun Do said. You caught me a little off guard. I'm not so good off the top of my head.
See, I knew that, said the captain. I knew that about you because we're family. You're the kind of guy who doesn't want anything for himself. You're a guy who doesn't need much. But when it comes to other people, the sky's the limit. You showed it the other day. You really proved it. And now you're acting like family. I went to jail for my crew, you know. I'm no hero, but I took 4 years so my boys could go home. That's how I showed it.
The captain was looking agitated, worried even. He was still holding the jar of urine, and Jun Do wanted to tell him to put it down. The captain moved to the edge of his chair, like maybe he was going to come down to the pallet.
Maybe it's just 'cause I'm old, the captain said. I mean, other people have problems. A lot of people have it worse off than me, but I just can't live without her. I just can't do it. It's where my mind goes. It always goes back to that. And I'm not mad or resentful about how it happened. I just need my wife. I've got to have her back. And see, you can do that. You're in a position to make that happen. Very soon, you're going to be able to say the word, and anything can happen.
Jun Do tried to speak, but the captain cut him off.
She's old. I know what you're thinking. I'm old too, but age doesn't have anything to do with it. In fact, it only seems to get worse with each year. Who would have thought it would get worse? Nobody tells you that. Nobody ever talks about that part.
The captain heard some dogs moving across the roof, and he looked up at the ceiling. He set down the jar and stood.
We would be strangers for a while, he said. After I got her back, there would be things she couldn't talk about, I know that. But a kind of discovery would begin, I'm sure of it. And then what we had would return.
The captain took up his chart.
Don't say anything, he said. Don't say anything at all. Just think about it. That's all I ask.
Then, in the candlelight, the captain rolled the chart tight with two hands. It was a gesture Jun Do had seen him make 1,000 times. It meant that a bearing had been chosen. The men had been tasked, and whether full nets or empty lay ahead, a decision was made. Events set in motion. From below in the courtyard came a whoop, followed by a sound that might have been a laugh or a cry, and Jun Do somehow knew that at the center of these drunk people was the second mate's wife. From above came the clicking nails of dogs standing to take an interest, and he followed the sounds as they moved to the edge of the roof. Even on the 10th floor, the windows managed to capture the sounds, and from all over the housing block came the squeaks of people cranking their louvered windows open to see which citizen was up to no good. Jun Do pulled himself up, and by pushing a chair like a walker, he made his way to the window. There was just a sliver of moon, and in the courtyard far below he located several people by their sharp laughs, though he could make out only the black sheen of them. He could picture the luster of her hair, though, the glow of her neck and shoulders. The town of Kinje was dark. The bread collective, the magistrate, the school, the ration station. Even the karaoke bar's generator was silent, its blue neon light gone blank. Wind whistled through the old cannery and heat waves emanated off the steaming chambers of the new. There was the outline of the canning master's house, and in the harbor was only a single light, the captain reading late aboard the Junma. Beyond that, the dark sea. Jundo heard a sniffing sound and looked up to the roof overhang to see two paws and a cocked puppy's face looking down at him. He'd lit a candle and was in a chair covered with a sheet when she came in, unsteady, through the door. She'd been crying.
"Assholes,"
she said and lit a cigarette.
"Come back," a voice yelled from the courtyard below. "We were only joking."
She went to the window and threw a fish down at them. She turned to Jundo.
"What are you looking at?"
From a chest of drawers, she grabbed some of her husband's clothes.
"Put a shirt on, would you?"
she said and threw a white undershirt at him. The shirt was small and smelled sharp, like the second mate. It was murder to get his arms through.
"Maybe the karaoke bar isn't the place for you," he said.
"Assholes,"
she said and smoked in the other chair, looking up as if there was something she was trying to figure out.
"All night long they were toasting my husband, the hero."
She ran a hand through her hair.
"I must have had 10 plum wines. Then they started picking sad songs on the karaoke machine. By the time I sang Pochonbo, I was practically a wreck. Then they were all fighting to take my mind off it."
"Why would you spend time with those guys?"
"I need them," she said. "My new husband's going to be picked soon. I have to make a good impression on people. They need to know I can sing. This is my chance."
"Those guys are local bureaucrats. They're nobodies." She grabbed her stomach in discomfort.
"I am so tired of getting fish parasites and then having to eat chlorine pills. Smell me. I reek of it. Can you believe my father did this to me? How can I get to Pyongyang when I smell like fish and chlorine?"
"Look," Jundo said, "I know it seems like a raw deal, but your father must have known the options. Certainly, he picked the one that was best for you."
It felt low and ugly to pass along the line that he'd fed so many times to the other boys. "You don't know what they were going through. Your parents wouldn't have put you in an orphanage if it wasn't their best option, maybe their only one."
"A couple times a year, these guys would come to town. They'd line up all the girls, and the pretty ones, they just..."
She leaned her head back and blew smoke.
"Disappeared. My father had a connection. He always got wind of it, and I'd stay home sick that day. Then he sends me down the coast to this place. But what's the point, you know? Why be safe? Why survive if you're going to gut fish for 50 years?
"What are those girls now?"
Jundo asked.
"Barmaids, room cleaners, worse? You think doing that for 50 years is any better?"
"If that's how it works, just say so. If that's what happens to them, tell me."
"I have no way of knowing. I've never been to the capital."
"Then don't call them whores then," she said. "Those girls were my friends."
She gave him an angry look.
"What kind of spy are you anyway?"
"I'm just a radio guy."
"Why don't I believe you? Why don't you have a real name? All I know about you is that my husband, who had the maturity of a 13-year-old, worshipped you. That's why he fiddled with your radios. That's why he nearly burned the ship up reading your dictionaries by candlelight in the toilet.
Wait, he said. The machinist said it was the wiring.
Suit yourself.
He started the fire?
You want to know the other things he didn't tell you about?
I would have taught him some English. All he had to do was ask. What did he want it for?
Oh, he was full of ridiculous plans.
To get out?
He said the key was a big distraction. He said the canning master had the right idea. Make a scene so gruesome that nobody wants to go near it. Then you slip away.
But the canning master's family, they didn't slip away.
No, she said, they didn't.
And after the distraction, what was the plan? She shrugged.
I never really wanted out, she said. He wanted the outside world. For me, it's Pyongyang. I finally got him to see that.
All the exertion had exhausted Jun-do. He pulled the yellow sheet tighter around his waist, but really, he wanted to lie down.
You look tired, she said. Are you ready for your jar?
I think I am, he said. She got the jar, but when he reached for it, she didn't let go. The two of them held it, and the candlelight made her eyes look bottomless.
Beauty means nothing here, she said. It's only how many fish you can process. No one cares that I can sing except the boys who want to take my mind off it. But Pyongyang, that's where the theater is, the opera, television, the movies. Only in Pyongyang will I matter. For all his faults, that's something my husband was trying to give me.
Jun-do took a deep breath. When he used the jar, the night would be over. And he didn't want that, because when she blew out the candle, the room would be as dark as the sea and the second mate upon it. I wish I had my radio, he said.
You've got a radio?
She asked.
Where is it?
He nodded toward the window and the canning master's house beyond. It's in my kitchen, he said. Jun-do slept all night, then woke in the morning. So turned around was his system now. All of the fish that had been strung through the room were gone, and sitting on the chair was his radio, the loose parts in a plastic bowl. When the news came on, he could feel the entire housing block hum with 200 loudspeakers. He stared at the place on the wall where the chart had been while he was informed of the coming negotiations in America, of the dear leader's inspection of a cement factory in Sinpo, of the news that North Korea had defeated the Libyan badminton team in straight sets, and finally, a reminder that it is illegal to eat swallows, as they control insect populations that feed on rice seedlings. Jun-do stood awkwardly and scrounged a piece of brown paper. Then he pulled on the blood-soaked pants he'd been wearing 4 days ago, when it all happened. Outside, at the end of the hall, was the line for the 10th-floor toilet. With all the adults at the cannery, the line was made up of old women and children, each waiting with scraps of paper in their hands. When it was his turn, though, Jun-do saw the wastebasket was filled instead with wadded pages of Rodong Shinmun, which was illegal to tear, let alone wipe your ass with. He was in there a long time. Finally, he scooped 2 ladles of water into the toilet, and when he was leaving, an old lady in line stopped him.
You're the one who lives in the canning master's house, she said.
That's right, Jun-do told her.
They should burn that place, she said.
The apartment door was open when he returned. Inside, Jun-do found the old man who'd interrogated him. He held the pair of Nikes in his hands.
What the hell is on your roof? He asked.
Dogs, Jun-do told him.
Filthy animals. You know they're illegal in Pyongyang. That's the way it should be. Besides, I'll take pork any day.
He held up the Nikes.
What are these?
They're some kind of American shoes, Jun-do told him. We found them in our nets one night. You don't say. What are they for?
It was hard to believe an interrogator from Pyongyang had never seen nice athletic shoes. Still, Jun Do said, they're for exercise, I think.
I've heard that, the old man said, that Americans do pointless labor for fun.
He pointed at the radio.
And what about this?
He said. That's work-related, Jun Do said. I'm fixing it.
Turn it on.
It's not all put together. Jun Do pointed at the bowl of parts. Even if it was, there's no antenna. The old man put the shoes back and walked to the window. The sun was high but still rising, and the angle made the water, despite its depth, shimmer light blue.
Look at that, he said. I could stare at that forever.
It's quite a lovely sea, sir, Jun Do said.
If a guy walked down to that dock and cast a line in, the old man said, would he catch a fish?
The place to catch a fish was a little to the south, where the canning factory's waste pipes pumped fish sludge into the sea. But Jun Do said,
yeah, I think he might. And up north, in Wonsan, the old man said, they have beaches there, no?
I've never visited, Jun Do told him. But you can see the sand from our ship.
Here, the old guy said, I brought you this.
He handed Jun Do a crimson velvet case.
It's your medal for heroism. I'd pin it on you, but I can tell you're not a medal guy. I like that about you.
Jun Do didn't open the case. The old interrogator looked again out the window.
To survive in this world, you got to be many times a coward, but at least once a hero.
Here he laughed.
At least that's what the guy told me one time, when I was beating the shit out of him.
I just want to get back on my boat, Jun Do said. The old interrogator took a look at Jun Do.
I think that salt water made your shirt shrink, he said.
He tugged Jun Do's sleeve up to look at the scars, which were red-lipped and wept at the corners. Jun Do pulled his arm back.
Easy there, tiger. There'll be plenty of time to fish. First, we've got to show those Americans. They've got to get theirs. I hear plans in motion, so we've got to get you presentable. Right now, it looks like the sharks won.
This is all some kind of test, isn't it? The old interrogator smiled.
What do you mean?
Asking about Wonsan like some kind of fool when everybody knows no one retires there. Everyone knows that's just a place for military leaders to vacation. Why not just say what you want from me? A flash of uncertainty crossed the old interrogator's face. It shifted slightly to measurement and then settled into a smile.
Hey, he said. I'm the one who's supposed to be rattling you.
He laughed.
Seriously, though. We're both legally heroes. We're on the same team. Our mission is to stick it to the Americans who did this to you. First, though, I need to know if you've got some kind of beef with the captain. We can't be having any surprises.
What are you talking about? Jun Do asked. Never. Not at all. He looked out the window. Half the fleet was out, but the Junma had its nets spread across the docks, drying them for a mend.
Okay, then. Forget I said anything. If you didn't say anything to piss him off, I believe you.
The captain's my family, Jun Do said. If you've got something to say about him, then you'd better say it.
It's nothing. The captain just came to me and asked if I could put you on another boat.
Jun Do stared at him in disbelief.
The captain said he's tired of heroes, that he only has so much time left, and he just wants to do his job and fish.
I wouldn't sweat it. The captain,
he's a capable man, A real solid hand. But you get old. You lose your flexibility. I've seen it many times.
John Doe sat down in a chair. It's because of his wife, he said. That's got to be it. That's something you guys did to him, giving his wife away.
I doubt that's how it worked. I'm not familiar with the case, but she was an old woman, right? Not too many replacement husbands are clamoring for an old woman. The captain went to jail and she left him. That sounds pretty likely. As the dear leader says, the simplest answer is usually the right one.
And the second mate's wife, are you handling that case?
She's a pretty girl. She'll do well. You don't have to worry about her. She won't be living underneath dogs anymore, that's for sure.
What will happen to her?
I think there's a warden in Sinpo who's high on the list, and down in Jongwang, there's a retired party official making some noise to get his hands on her.
I thought girls like her got sent to Pyongyang. The old man cocked his head.
She's no virgin, he finally said. Plus, she's 20 now, and headstrong. Most of the girls who go to Pyongyang are 17. All they know is how to listen. But what do you care? You don't want her for yourself, do you?
No, Jundo said. Not at all.
'Cause that's suddenly not so heroic. If you want a girl, we can get you a girl. But the wife of a fallen comrade, that's discouraged.
I'm not saying that's what I want, Jundo said. But I'm a hero. I've got rights.
Privileges, the old man said. You get some privileges.
All day he worked on the radio. The light was good at the window ledge. There he used the flattened end of a wire as a jeweler's screwdriver and melted fine strands of solder with a candle flame. There, too, he could keep an eye on the harbor to observe the captain pacing the decks. Toward twilight she returned. She was in high spirits, radiant.
I see some of you still works, she said.
I couldn't stay in bed without any fish to look at. They were my mobile.
Some impression that would make, she said. Showing up in Pyongyang with a suitcase full of fish.
Then she pulled back her hair to reveal a new pair of earrings made from thin tails of gold.
Not a bad trade, huh? I'll have to wear my hair up so people can see them.
She went to the radio.
Does it work?
Yeah, he said. Yeah, I rigged an antenna. We should set it up on the roof, though, before the power goes out. She grabbed the pair of Nikes.
Okay, she said. But there's something I've got to do first.
They took the stairs carefully, down to the sixth floor. They passed apartments ringing with family arguments, but most were eerily silent. The walls here were painted with slogans to the dear and great leaders, accompanied by depictions of children singing from the songbooks of the revolution, and peasant farmers pausing at their rich harvests, sickles high, to gaze into the pure light of everlasting wisdom. The second mate's wife knocked on a door, waited a moment, then went inside. The windows were covered with ration paper, and the room smelled of the crotch rot that would spread through the DMZ tunnels. Here they found a man sitting in a plastic dining chair, a bandaged foot elevated on a stool. From the shape of the bandages, you could tell there was no room for toes. He wore overalls from the canning factory, and his name patch said, Team Leader Gunn. Gunn's eyes lit when he saw the shoes. He beckoned for them, then turned them in his hands, smelled them.
Can you get more of these?
He asked her.
Maybe,
she said. She saw a box on a table, about the size of a funeral cake.
Is this it?
Yes, he said, marveling at the Nikes. Then he pointed at her box.
That wasn't easy to get, you know. It's straight from the south.
Without looking inside, she put the box under her arm.
"What does your friend want?"
Gun asked her. Jundo looked around the room, at the cases of strange Chinese liquor, and the bins of old clothing, at the dangling wires where a loudspeaker should have been. There was a birdcage jammed full with rabbits. He answered for himself, "I don't need anything."
"Ah, but I asked what you want,"
Gun said, smiling for the first time.
"Come, accept a gift. I think I have a belt that will fit you."
He strained for a plastic bag on the floor that was filled with used belts.
"Don't bother," Jundo told him.
The second mate's wife saw a pair of shoes she liked. They were black and almost new. While she tried them on, Jundo looked at all the crates of merchandise. There were Russian cigarettes and baggies of pills with handwritten labels, and a dish filled with sunglasses. There was a stack of family cooking pans, their handles pointing in different directions, and they seemed almost tragic to him. On a small bookshelf, he found his English dictionaries, and he looked over his old notes in the margins, noting all the idioms he'd once found impossible, like dry run and close but no cigar. Rummaging further, he found the badger hair shaving brush that had belonged to the captain. Jundo didn't blame the second mate for pilfering things, even personal things. But when Jundo turned to observe the second mate's wife regard the black shoes in a mirror, it suddenly mattered whether it was she or her husband who'd sold them here.
"Okay," she said. "I want them."
"They look good," Gun said. "That leather is Japanese, you know? The best. You bring me another pair of Nikes and we'll trade."
"No,"
she said.
"The Nikes are far too valuable. When I get another pair, we'll see what you have that's equal."
"When you get another pair, you will bring them to me. Agreed?"
"Agreed,"
she said.
"Good," he said. "You take those shoes, and then you can owe me one."
"I'll owe you one,"
she said.
"Don't do it," Jundo told her.
"I'm not afraid,"
she said.
"Good," Gun told her. "When the time comes that you can be of service, I will come for you, and then we will be even."
Box under her arm, they turned to go. On a small table, though, something caught Jundo's eye. He picked it up. It was a station master's watch on a little chain. The orphan master had had such a watch, and with it he ran their entire lives from dawn to lights out, as he farmed the boys out to clean septic tanks or to be sent down shafts on bare ropes to drain oil sumps. Every moment went by that watch, and he'd never tell the boys the time, but they learned by his facial expressions how things would go until he next checked it.
"Take the watch," Gun said. "I got it from an old man who said it ran perfectly for a lifetime."
Jundo set down the watch. When they'd left and the door closed behind them, he asked, "What happened to him?"
"He hurt his foot last year from a steam line under pressure. Something like that."
"Last year?"
"The wound won't close. That's what the foreman says."
"You shouldn't have made that deal with him," Jundo said.
"When he comes to collect," she told him, "I'll be long gone."
Jundo looked at her. In this moment, he felt truly sad for her. He thought of the men who were lobbying for her, the warden in Xinpo and the old party boss in Chongwang, men who were right now preparing their homes for her arrival. Had they been shown a photo of her, told some kind of story, or had they only heard over their loudspeakers the tragic news that a hero had been lost to the sharks, leaving a beautiful young wife behind? Winding the stairwell to the roof, they pushed through the metal door into darkness and stars. The adult dogs were free and skittish, their eyes locating them. In the center of the roof, there was a screened-in shed to keep insects off the sides of dog, rubbed with coarse salt and crushed green peppercorns, hanging to cure in the ocean air.
"It's beautiful up here,"
he said.
Sometimes I come up here to think, she said.
They looked far out onto the water.
What's it like out there?
She asked.
When you're out of sight of shore, he said, you could be anybody, from anywhere. It's like you have no past. Out there, everything is spontaneous, every lick of water that kicks up, every bird that drops in from nowhere. Over the airwaves, people say things you'd never imagine. Here, nothing is spontaneous.
I can't wait to hear that radio, she said. Can you get the pop stations from Seoul?
It's not that kind of radio, he said, and jammed the antenna through the mesh of the puppy warren, the little dog scurrying in terror.
I don't get it.
Jundo tossed the cable off the overhang, where they could retrieve it from the window below. This radio doesn't receive broadcasts, he said. It transmits them.
What's the point of that?
We have a message to send.
Inside the apartment, his fingers worked quickly to hook up the antenna cable and a small microphone.
I had a dream, he told her. I know it doesn't make any sense, but I dreamed your husband had a radio, that he was on a raft, heading into shimmering water, bright like a thousand mirrors.
Okay, she said.
Jundo turned the radio on and they both stared at the sodium yellow glow of its power meter. He set it to 63 megahertz, then squeezed the breaker bar.
Third mate to second mate. Third mate to second mate. Over.
Jundo repeated this, knowing that just as he couldn't hear, the second mate couldn't respond. Finally, he said, My friend, I know you're out there, and you mustn't despair. Jundo could have explained how to unbraid a single strand of copper from the battery leads, then connect the strand to both poles so it would heat up enough to light a cigarette. Jundo could have told the second mate how to make a compass from the magnet in the radio's windings, or how surrounding the capacitors is a foil he could flash as a signal mirror. But the survival skills the second mate needed concerned enduring solitude and tolerating the unknown, topics about which Jundo had some practice.
Sleep during the day, Jundo told him. At night, your thoughts will come clear. We have looked at the stars together. Chart them each night. If they are in the right places, you're doing fine. Use your imagination only on the future, never on the present or the past. Do not try to picture people's faces. You will despair if they don't come clear. If you are visited by people from far away, don't think of them as ghosts. Treat them as family. Ask them questions. Be a good host.
You will need a purpose, he told the second mate. The captain's purpose was to get us home safe. Your purpose will be to stay strong, so that you can rescue the girl who rose in the dark. She is in trouble and needs help. You're the only one out there who can help her. Scan the horizons at night. Look for lights and flares. You must save her for me. I'm sorry that I let you down. It was my job to look out for you. I was supposed to save you, and I failed. You were the real hero. When the Americans came, you saved us all. And when you needed us, we weren't there for you. Somehow, one day, I'll make things right. Jundo stopped broadcasting, and the needle on the meter went flat. The second mate's wife just looked at him.
That must have been one sad dream, because that was the saddest message one person ever sent another.
When Jundo nodded, she said,
Who was the girl who rose in the dark?
I don't know, he said. She was just in the dream. He handed the microphone to her. I think you should say something to him, he said. She didn't take it.
This is about your dream, not mine. What would I say?
She asked.
What would I tell him?
What would you have told him if you knew you'd never see him again? He asked. Or you don't have to say anything. He told me how much he loved your singing. Jun-Dil went to his knees, turned and rolled onto the pallet. On his back, he took several large breaths. When he tried to pull the shirt off, he found he couldn't.
Don't listen,
she told him. He put his fingers in his ears, the same inside feeling as wearing headphones, and watched her lips move. She spoke only for a little bit. Her eyes pointed toward the windows, and when he realized she was singing, he opened his ears and welcomed the sound, a children's lullaby.
The cat's in the cradle. The baby's in the tree. The birds up above all click their beaks. Papa's in the tunnel, preparing for the storm. Here comes Mama. Her hands are worn. She holds out her apron for the baby to see. The baby full of trust. Let's go, the tree.
Her voice was simple and pure. Everyone knew their lullabies, but how did he know his? Had someone ever sung them to him, from before he could remember? When she was done, she turned off the radio. The lights would go off soon, so she lit a candle. She came to his side, and there was something new in her eyes.
I needed that, she said. I didn't know I needed that.
She took a deep breath.
I feel like something's been lifted.
That was beautiful, he said. I recognized that lullaby.
Of course you did,
she said.
Everyone knows it.
She put her hand on the box.
I've been carrying this around, and not once have you asked what it is.
So show me, he said.
Close your eyes,
she told him. He did. First came the unzipping of her canning line jumpsuit, and then he heard the whole process. The opening of the box, the shuffle of stiff satin, the shush as she stepped into it and drew it up her legs, and then the whisper as it spun on her body, the shimmy of a final position, and then her arms, almost without sound, entering the sleeves.
You can open your eyes now,
she told him, but he did not want to. Eyes closed, he could see her skin in long flashes, in the comfortable manner of someone unobserved. She was trusting him, completely, and he wished for anything but to have that end. She kneeled beside him again, and when he did open his eyes, he saw she was in a shimmering yellow dress.
This is the kind they wear in the West,
she said. You're beautiful, he told her.
Let's get that shirt off.
She slid a leg over his waist, the hem of her dress enveloping his midsection. Straddling him, she pulled his arms till he was sitting up, then taking hold of his shirt, she let the gravity of his return peel it off. I can see those earrings from here, he said.
Maybe I don't need to cut my hair then.
He looked up at her. The yellow of her dress shined in the black of her hair. She asked him,
How come you never married?
Bad songbun.
Oh, she said. Were your parents denounced?
No, he answered. People think I'm an orphan.
That will do it,
she said, then hesitated.
Sorry, that sounded bad, the way I said that.
What was there to say? Jun-Dil shrugged at her. She said,
You said my husband's purpose was to save the girl who rode in your dreams.
I just told him that to keep him strong and focused, Jun-Dil said. The mission is always to stay alive.
My husband isn't alive, is he? You'd tell me, right?
Yes, I tell you, Jundo said. But no, he's not alive. She looked in his eyes.
My lullaby. Could everybody hear that broadcast?
Anyone on the East Sea.
What about Pyongyang? Could they hear it there?
No, he said. That's too far. There's mountains. The signal travels farther over water.
But anyone who was listening,
she said. Ships, navigation stations, naval craft, they all heard. And I'm sure he heard you too.
In this dream of yours?
In my dream, yes, Jundo said. The dream of him floating away. The bright lights, his radio. It's as real as the sharks rising out of the dark water, as the teeth in my arm. I know one is real and one's a dream, but I keep forgetting which is which. They're both so true. I can't tell anymore. I don't know which one.
Choose the beautiful story, with the bright lights, the one where he can hear us, she told him. That's the true one, not the scary story, not the sharks.
But isn't it more scary to be utterly alone upon the waters, completely cut off from everyone, no friends, no family, no direction, nothing but a radio for solace? She touched the side of his face.
That's your story, she said. You're trying to tell me your story, aren't you?
Jundo stared at her.
Oh, you poor boy, she said. You poor little boy. It doesn't have to be that way. Come in off the water. Things can be different. You don't need a radio. I'm right here. You don't have to choose the alone.
She leaned in close and kissed him tenderly on the forehead, and once on each cheek. She sat up and regarded him. She stroked his hand. When she leaned in again, moving as if to kiss him, she paused, staring at his chest. What is it? He asked.
It's stupid, she said.
She covered her mouth. No, it isn't. Tell me.
I'm just used to looking down at my husband and seeing my face over his heart. I've never known anything different.
When the shockwork whistles blew in the morning and the housing block was a hive of loudspeakers, they went onto the roof to remove the antenna. The morning sun was flat and brilliant upon the waters, yet lacking the heat to revive the flies or the stink of dog waste. The dogs, which seemed to snap and herd one another all day, were cowered in a single sleeping mass in the crisp morning air, their coats white with dew. The second mate's wife walked to the edge of the roof and sat with her legs swinging over the edge. Jundo joined her, but the sight of the courtyard 10 stories below made him close his eyes a moment.
I won't be able to use morning as an excuse much longer, she said. At work, they'll hold a criticism session about me and reinstate my quota.
Below, a steady procession of workers in their jumpsuits crossed the courtyard, traversing the fish cart paths and passing the canning master's house for the gates of the fish processing factory.
They never look up, she said. I sit out here all the time and watch them. No one has ever looked up and caught me.
Jundo found the courage to gaze down upon them, and it was nothing like looking into the depths of the ocean. 100 feet of air or sea alike would kill you, but the water would shuttle you, slowly, to a new realm. Toward the sea, the sun was now hard to look at, so many flashes off the water. If it reminded her of Jundo's dream about her husband, she didn't show it. The Junma could now be discerned from the other helms in the harbor, its peculiar bow to stern pitch from even the slightest wake of a passing vessel. Its nets were back aboard, and it would be upon the water again soon. By shielding his eyes and squinting, Jundo could make out a figure at the rail, looking down into the water. Only the captain would stare into the water like that. Below, in the courtyard, a black Mercedes pulled up. It drove very slowly over the small, rutted fish cart path and came to a stop in the grass of the courtyard. Two men in blue suits got out.
"I can't believe it," she said. "It's happening."
The men below shielded their eyes and gave the building a once-over. At the sound of their car door slamming shut, the dogs stood and shook the wet from their fur. She turned to Jundo.
"It's really happening."
Then she made for the metal door of the stair shaft. The first thing she did was pull on her yellow dress, and this time there was no asking Jundo to close his eyes. She moved frantically through the one-room apartment, throwing things in her suitcase.
"I can't believe they're here already," she said.
She looked around the room, the expression on her face suggesting that everything she needed was eluding her.
"I'm not ready. I didn't get a chance to cut my hair. I'm not even close to being ready."
"I care about what happens to you," Jundo told her. "And I can't let them do this to you." She was pulling items from a chest of drawers.
"That's sweet," she said. "You're sweet too, but this is my destiny. I have to go."
"We got to get you out of here," Jundo told her. "Maybe we can get you to your father. He'll know what to do."
"Are you insane?" she asked. "He's how I got stuck here."
For some reason, she handed him a stack of clothes. "There's something I should have told you," he said.
"About what?"
"The old interrogator. He described the guys they picked out for you."
"What guys?"
"Your replacement husbands." She stopped packing.
"There's more than one?"
"One's a warden in Xinpo. The other guy's old, a party official down in Chongwang. The interrogator didn't know which one was going to get you." She cocked her head in confusion.
"There's got to be some kind of mistake."
"Let's just get you out of here," he said. "It'll buy you some time till they come back."
"No,"
she said, her eyes fixing on him.
"You can do something about this. You're a hero. You have powers. They can't say no to you."
"I don't think so," Jundo said. "I don't think it works like that. Not really."
"Tell them to go away. Tell them you're marrying me."
There was a knock at the door. She grabbed his arm.
"Tell them you're marrying me,"
she said. He studied her face, vulnerable. He'd never seen her like this. "You don't want to marry me," he told her.
"You're a hero," she said. "And I'm a hero's wife. You just need to come to me."
She took the hem of her skirt and held it out like an apron.
"You're the baby in the tree, and you just need to trust me."
He went to the door but paused before opening it.
"You talked about my husband's purpose," she said. "What about yours? What if your purpose is me?"
"I don't know if I have a purpose," he told her. "But you know yours. It's Pyongyang, not a radio man in Kinje. Don't underestimate yourself. You'll survive."
"Survive like you?"
she asked. He didn't say anything.
"You know what you are?"
she said.
"You're a survivor who has nothing to live for."
"What would you rather? That I die for something I cared about?"
"That's what my husband did,"
she said. The door was forced open. It was the two men from below. They didn't look happy about all those stares.
"Bak Jundo?"
one asked, and when Jundo nodded, the man said,
"You'll need to come with us."
The other one asked, "Have you got a suit?" The men in suits drove Jundo along the cannery tracks before following a military road that wound up and out of the hills above Ginje. Jundo turned and watched everything recede in glimpses through the rear window. Through cuts in the road, he could see boats bobbing blue in the harbor and ceramic tiles flashing from the canning master's roof. He saw for a moment the town's red spire honoring April 15th. The town looked suddenly like one of the happy villages they paint on the side of ration buildings. Going over the hill, there was only a plume of steam rising high from the cannery, a last